You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 29th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infections of Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. On where do we go from here? Meanwhile, GOP mask off as moves to so-called open their state's economies are just to undermine workers. Meanwhile, Trump says no more stimulus, just raids of Social Security funds. This is all the while GDP and consumer confidence plunges. But fortunately, U.S. to lend $500 billion to corporations with zero strings. New data suggests significantly more deaths than have been reported. And new documents show, surprise, Roger Stone lied. He was in contact with Julian Assange. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, 52 coronavirus cases tied to the Wisconsin election. That's on the Wisconsin and U.S. Supreme Court and Republicans in the law, in the state house in Wisconsin. And Donald Trump sort of orders meat plants to stay open. In New York, Andrew Yang sues over the shuttering of the primary. Justin Amash may run for president, and Meghan Harper sadly loses in Ohio. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I should also add Joe Biden won in the presidential primary there in Ohio, to the extent that that is still relevant. It's obviously in no way surprising. He's the only person who is whose campaign is active in the presidential race. We have a pre-taped interview today. I did this Friday morning with Dr. Osterholm. He is one epidemiologist in the country. I think he did a an interview with Joe Rogan. I think it was in early March or February, late February. 14 million views. Fascinating stuff. It's also amazing to me how much we do not seem to know at this point about the coronavirus. I have been reading and talking to some experts in this, and there is they are still not totally clear as to how much antibodies you need in your system to be protected from reinfection. It seems that the virus does not necessarily reactivate like some viruses do. In other words, go dormant in your body and then reactivate. But again, we need to know a lot more about the virus. And the right, in many respects, is taking advantage of these sort of unknowns about the virus to fill that vacuum with complete fictions. I mean, there apparently are people who are making a lot of money out of this. You know, we talked about yesterday how Diamond and Silk got fired from Fox Nation because they were suggesting that the coronavirus was a function of 5G technology, we should be so lucky. It has not been rolled out in this country in the way that we were promised it would be by this point. But so in addition to all the smart stuff in your home, your smart refrigerator that you'll have because of 5G, they would let you believe that you also get coronavirus from it. Now, that's way out of bounds. So we'll fire them. However, one of our top shows in primetime will just espouse absolute lies and nonsense. We will cover some of that later in the program. And we will talk about Donald Trump's. Really, there's a 1-2-3 punch going on here. One is the states are basically culling their unemployment rolls by forcing people to come into work. The federal government intends to help in that effort by, if Mitch McConnell has his way, extending essentially immunity from and releasing employers from their statutory obligation to provide a safe work environment under our OSHA laws. And therefore, they can't be sued. So they'll open up. Their employees will either come in or not come in because they will not be able to get unemployment if they don't come in. They'll work until they get sick, and then there'll be no recourse on the, for them because these corporations, these businesses will have immunity. And then the third punch is Donald Trump is going to is claiming no more. And this, you know, these are the negotiations going in. There's some of this is kabuki. Donald Trump saying no stimulus checks. We're just going to do payroll cuts from Social Security. Now, that should be obvious to everyone that, A, we're going to have 40 million people who have lost their jobs. It's again going to force people to come in to work in these places where they have no protections, because otherwise, how do you get any cut on your Social Security taxes if you're not working and getting a paycheck? And then, of course, I guess it's really a 1-2-3-4 punch because it sets up the Republicans to cut Social Security and push for that in the event a Democratic president wins, or even if Donald Trump is president in a year. Because, oh, look, the Social Security funds have been depleted. So that's what's going on there. We'll hopefully get more in depth in a moment. Just a bit of house cleaning. A reminder, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. But also, if you have been watching the AM Quickie on YouTube, as opposed to, say, like Instagram, where it was just liked by AOC, which was very exciting for Dorsey and for me. But if you've been watching on YouTube, know that we have switched it over to our backup YouTube channel, which is Majority Report Live. So it's youtube.com/Majority Report Live. It will live there going forward. We may dip it in to the current channel, but that's where you will find it going forward. So if you're looking for the AM Quickie, that's where it is. youtube.com/Majority Report Live. Here is Donald Trump playing the hits again. Sometimes the oldies were so great that you can't let go of them. I know you all remember that back in February 28th, back when we were living sort of normal lives, more or less, Donald Trump said that the coronavirus will disappear like a miracle. Just one day will go away. Maybe it would be the warm weather. Who knows? And, you know, maybe that'll be the case, but not before it takes the lives of thousands of thousands and tens of thousands of Americans. But he liked it so much the first time. Yesterday at the White House, he tried it again.
remarks that you feel the worst of the pandemic is behind us. But without a treatment, without a vaccine, the state's now reopening. How can you be so sure?
Well, I think that, like other things, we're going to come up with a vaccine. You never know about a vaccine, but tremendous progress has been made. Johnson & Johnson and Oxford and lots of good things. You've been hearing the same things as I do. Tremendous progress has been made, we think, on a vaccine. You always have to say think, and then you have to test it, and that takes a period of time. But a lot of movement and a lot of progress has been made on a vaccine. But I think what happens is it's going to go away. This is going to go away. And whether it comes back in a modified form in the fall, we'll be able to handle it. We'll be able to put out spurts. And we're very prepared to handle it. We've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about it, the invisible enemy. It's a bad enemy. It's a very tough enemy. But we've learned a lot. It's in 184 countries, as you hear me say often. It's hard to believe. It's inconceivable. It should have been stopped at the source, which was China. It should have been stopped very much at the source, but it wasn't. And now we have 184 countries going through hell. But I think that a lot of good things are going to happen. And I really believe that fourth quarter is going to be maybe tremendous. And the next year, I think, has a chance to be really getting close to record setting. We hope so. We hope we can be back where we were. We had the strongest economy anywhere in the world, and I hope we're going to be back there again. Go ahead, please.
I don't think so.
How much confidence are people feeling now? Do people feel better? It's just going to go away. We have an epidemiologist on the program today, and it won't just go away. We may at one point reach herd immunity. There's only one route to get to herd immunity. And the numbers that we have in New York, let's say New York City, it's possible anywhere from 15 to 20, 25%, probably closer to 15% of people have already been infected. And we know at what cost that came in terms of deaths. And probably illnesses that will cause long-term medical issues. And so, it may take another 20,000, 30,000 more deaths to get to close to herd immunity, to get to close. Maybe it'll be 40,000 in New York. And that assumes that we don't have a surge where it spikes, where we overrun capacity. We didn't overrun capacity last time, but who knows what happens in the next peak. But of course, around the country, we're looking closer to 5%. And we have now had at least over 50,000, close to 60,000 deaths that are directly attributable to coronavirus. There's a piece in Scientific American that made clear that the way that we count flu deaths is algorithmic. So the way that we've been counting coronavirus deaths, without looking at the disparities of year-to-year deaths that are, you know, we're starting to see numbers now. The Times had a piece today where it's, if you compare the month of April or the month of March, let's say, to prior Marches and Aprils, we have this unaccounted for spike in deaths that don't include the coronavirus deaths. And this is happening all over the country and in different countries. It is reasonable to assume that those deaths are a function of coronavirus. There's no other reason why we would have unaccounted for deaths. Now, it could be a function of coronavirus directly. It could also be a function of, like, people aren't getting treatment because coronavirus has overwhelmed our medical system enough that people can't go in and get treated for other things. That's possible. But in terms of actual counting of coronavirus deaths, where the people die and they are on their birth certificate, coronavirus is at least one of the causes of deaths. if you were to calculate flu deaths annually in that way, the top amount of flu deaths we would have would be somewhere around 16,000. And they would range from about 3,000 to 16,000. But things are extrapolated. So the number of coronavirus deaths relative to the flu, you know, we've done this in 1 month with coronavirus, it's not even close. It's far more lethal. But Donald Trump, he liked it so well the first time that he said it would just go away. He figured he'd try it again.
Makes me think of the Beach Boys, Wouldn't It Be Nice? Just playing.
Yes. That would be good, actually. But we don't want to get dinged for copyright. I mean, the polling is starting to show that people are just simply not listening to Donald Trump anymore. And I think I read that the top networks have decided they're not going to cover the press conferences anymore because he's just pumping out disinformation. But let me say this too. This ad is a warning. Our democracy, as you probably know, is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they would have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. As of today, the AP reports at least 50 plus people contracted coronavirus on that day. The Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and voter roll purges. Now, a progressive movement is rising up to fight back because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. We simply cannot trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/majority. That's demandjustice.org/majority. Folks know that I really have been touting that organization since its inception. I don't know, I guess about maybe a year ago or something. I'm not sure. I should also tell you this episode is brought to you by Magic Spoon. Breakfast cereal is one of the best parts of being a kid, right? Fred for Matt, too, even now. Sit down, bowl of cereal, milk. You drink the milk after the cereal's gone. A complete breakfast all in a bowl. But as an adult, you realize all your favorites, full of sugar, full of junk. Magic Spoon is a new cereal company that's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with, you ready for this? Zero sugar. 12 grams of protein and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. Magic Spoon offers 4 flavors based on the all-time classics, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry. Plus a variety pack that lets you try them all. They've recreated the taste and the texture of classic sugary cereal. But it tastes so incredible, you'd never guess that it's actually healthy. It's keto-friendly, it's gluten-free, it's grain-free, it's soy-free, it's low-carb, and it's GMO-free. For me, personally, cocoa. That's the one I go for. I don't even know if you're allowed to say the name of the cereal that... Well, there was a couple of them, I guess. But I know the one I'm thinking of. I don't know if they want me to say that name, but it's that one. And also the one with the vampire with the cocoa. It's delicious. And I got to say, the best thing about it, I can get my kids to eat it too. And instead of eating the crappy sugary cereals that they want, they're eating what they think are sugary cereals, but not. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. Grab a variety pack. Try it today. Use the promo code Majority Report at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money. No questions asked whatsoever. That's magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code majority report for free shipping. And lastly, speaking of shipping, if you've got a growing business, if you're thinking about starting something now while we're all stuck inside, Shippo is your new secret weapon. Shippo is the only shipping software for growing businesses that you can start today, set up in minutes, and then ship today. Shippo's volume discounts save you up to 90% off of carrier rates. You simply connect your online store to Shippo. You don't need any coding or technical experience at all. And instantly, you see the lowest shipping rates from over 55 top global carriers like UPS, USPS, FedEx, DHL. So if you got any type of online store, all you got to do is you just click, you print, you ship. They have automated return labels that are free. You only pay if your customers use them. Companies that use Shippo save thousands of dollars. They free up hours and they grow on average 77% each year. Join over 100,000 companies like Goat, Hims, MeUndies who use Shippo. For our listeners, they're offering their best discount available anywhere. Get a shipping consultation and a shipping pro plan 6-month trial. You ready for this? For free at goshippo.com/report. That's a $700 value for free at goshippo.com/report. They want you to try this because they know it's going to work out for you. You go right now, you get your shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at goshippo.com/report. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, an interview I recorded with Dr. Michael Osterholm of the Center for Infections and Disease Research and Policy at University of Minnesota a couple of days ago. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Dr. Michael Osterholm, he is the director of Center for Infectious Disease and Research and Policy. Welcome to the program, doctor.
Thank you.
And I should also say that you are obviously author of Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs, which was from 2017 and warned about the situation that we're in now, just to provide that context. Well, let me ask you this, because I've seen interviews I saw you on Rogan's show in early March. Just give me a sense of where we are now in terms of how you would have predicted we would be at this point.
Well, once we predicted this was going to be a pandemic, the only model we really had to base it upon is influenza pandemics. Remember, pandemics are worldwide epidemics, and we realized as early as mid-January that the transmission occurring in China surely did mean that we were going to see this person-to-person transmission around the world. Based on, at the time, what we saw for how fast the cases were multiplying, in other words, doubling about every 5 days, that it would take a period of a month or more once outside of China before it would really start to show up in communities. So it would go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, 16 to 32 cases. And that then at that point in late February, early March, we'd begin to see these case clusters, including some hotspots in larger demographic areas, occur around the world, which it did. Now, the challenge is beyond that, we don't know how this coronavirus is going to act in terms of an influenza-like picture. If it does, what we could surely expect is we could have an initial set of these hot spots with transmission in countries, but not nearing at all the kind of transmission you'd expect to see with a big peak of cases, meaning that in the United States, for example, right now, our best guesstimate is that, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15% of the population has been infected, regardless of, you know, where you're at, whether it's in New York, where we've had a great deal of activity, still at most 15% infected there. In many other parts of the country, about 5%. So that the next step is, well, what's going to happen? And there's really several scenarios, but they're all based on the following. And that is that this virus is not going to rest. It is going to keep seeking humans until it gets to about 60 to 70% of the population infected. By that time, we'd have enough infected individuals who would likely and hopefully be immune that would mean that it would help put, in a sense, immune rods in the virus transmission reaction so that I wouldn't transmit to people if 70% were now immune and it would eventually start to die out some. But to get to 70%, where you only have 5 or 15% currently having never had it, that leaves a lot of people left to get infected. So then how does that play out? Well, if it's like influenza and pandemics of the past, where this new influenza virus emerges, two started in the winter of the last 10, by the way, in the world over the last 250 years. Two started in the winter, three started in the spring, two started in the summer, and three started in the winter of our northern hemisphere. In every instance, the big peak occurred about 6 months after the initial peaks occurred. And so you could say if this is going to be like that, we could surely expect in the fall a big peak of cases. Now, why these early peaks occurred and then went away, we don't know. If you look at these influenza pandemics, it wasn't because of human behavior at the time that somehow changed them. Now, I do believe that what we've done recently is flatten the curve, as the term has become known, to basically hold down cases with our distancing activities. But what it'll do in the future, I think, is still really unclear. The other options are that we could just continue to see the kind of activity we see now, almost kind of a whack-a-mole type thing, where it pops up somewhere, we try to shut it down with distancing, and we keep going on until we get closer and closer to that 60 to 70% infection rate. We could have a situation where it's just slow burn, just constant, just from here on out. But the magic number is going to be that 60 to 70% infection before we see this slow down. Now, the one thing that can change that, of course, is a vaccine. But, you know, that means we're talking at least 16 to 18 months, I believe, before we would ever see vaccine researched, approved, manufactured, and distributed worldwide to actually have an impact on this. So between now and the next 15 to 16 months is going to be a real challenge for us.
So if the only realistic path for this to end is to get to that 60 to 70% infection rate, is the challenge now from a public health policy and I guess just broadly a public policy to essentially reach a number of, let's say, daily infections that is the highest number possible that could allow for our healthcare system to absorb? I mean, is that essentially the challenge? If you were in charge, if anybody were in charge, it feels like, but if you were in charge of essentially outlining the plan, would that be the strategic goal?
Yes. I think two things. One is, first of all, we've got to have a plan. You know, we can't just assume that we're either going to be in lockdown mode. And this is not just about the economy, because it's easy at that point to assume it's about dollars and cents versus lives. And it's not that. It's about our livelihood. It's about the society that we know. We can't lock down worldwide for 18 or 20 months hoping for a vaccine. At the same time, we can't just let this go willy-nilly, because in fact, when these big increases occur, they really will bring down healthcare systems. There very easily could be millions of deaths. And on top of that, the people who have other conditions will be largely denied access to healthcare because the systems will be under such strain. So that all the other illnesses that we think of will also be compromised in terms of how we deal with them, heart attacks, accidents, asthma, et cetera. So what I keep coming back to is what I talk about, threading the rope through the needle. We've got to find a way in that middle ground to say that how do we craft a response that is quickly able to determine that cases appear to be increasing, and we locally, regionally apply distancing techniques to try to slow it down, and then ease off again when we are able to demonstrate that cases are coming down, that the healthcare system has capacity to handle more surge, healthcare workers are protected because there's enough preventive equipment available, and that we can feel confident that, you know, we can kind of do what we're trying to do right now. But I think the additional challenge with that is that we know that this disease is very, very different in how it impacts people by age and by underlying risk factors, meaning diabetes, heart disease, certain cancers, hypertension, and obesity. And those people are at a much, much higher risk of having a serious illness and dying. So is there a way to help bring back into everyday life the younger population under age 40, for example, who will have a much lower risk of having a serious illness or and even a fatal case? And with the idea that we're not forcing them back in, but should there be a permissive way that we allow them back in? If they get infected, they still, we want them to not transmit it to others who are in high risk of having severe outcomes. But each time one of those people get infected and recover and develop immunity, which again, we're assuming will provide protection, we've put one more rod in that virus transmission reactor that will help slow things down. And that person now not only is not in a position to get infected themselves, but as well as the fact they can now interact with people who haven't been infected and feel confident and comfortable they're not going to transmit the virus to them. So that's the kind of discussion we need to have today, and it's a tough one. You know, we've had tough ones already about deciding who gets a ventilator and who doesn't, and what that means, a life and death decisions. But we also need to have a societal discussion today. And you know, I've seen people say, well, if you let any case happen, you're, you know, basically putting the economy over human life. No, this virus is doing that. This virus is very, very capable of continuing to march on no matter how hard we try to suppress it. There'll be cases. Look at places like Singapore, Japan, models just months ago of the way to do it to control it. And today they're both in national states of emergency. So our job is to figure out how to thread this rope through the needle and to get us through to what will hopefully be a vaccine with the fewest number of people who are impacted, if serious illness or deaths, who we don't overrun the healthcare system, and yet we maintain a sense of society and the livelihoods that we all know we have to do.
So this is going to be too rough, but and maybe you can sort of point out where there's where the math maybe is not wrong, but really the calculus is wrong. So if the idea is that we need to get to 60 to 70%, that there's a there, that means that there is an inevitability of X amount of deaths. We don't know what X amount of deaths is, because the variables, is what you're saying, is that if we were to, let's just look at New York City, because that's obviously the densest part, and that's so far been one of the, well, certainly by sheer numbers, the biggest epicenter. But so if we were to basically say, okay, everyone under the age of 40 in good health, you go out, and the idea is that we want to try and get as close as we can to 60 to 70% of infection with the least amount of deaths, because that's the strongest, or, you know, relative to the virus population that we have. And get there as quickly as we can. So if I was to look at the number of, we've had 15,000 deaths at this point, partly as a function of the shutdown, partly as a function of not having shut down, you know, earlier. Do you have folks who are sitting down sort of crunching those numbers and saying the high end of what we anticipate would be deaths if we were to do something like put 40-year-olds out there, and the low end is this?
Well, again, I think it comes back to, we don't want anybody to get infected, okay? So what I'm suggesting is, if they do participate in everyday life again, as we once knew, and they do get infected, I'm giving you the consequences of their chances of having a serious illness or dying, their ability to maintain a society as we know it, and at the same time, their situation in terms of, yes, you're right, putting rods in the reaction, but I wouldn't have them go back in it just to put rods in the reaction. I wouldn't do that. I'm just saying that if they happen, they actually contribute to that. You know, if I had the perfect magic wand, I'd freeze everything right now in human and virus time except one thing, and that's vaccine development. And then miraculously, 16 or 18 months from now, we just drop that vaccine in and then let time start again. We can't do that. So what we're trying to figure out is, how do we navigate this? It's like gravity. You might not like it, but it works, and it's going to work consistently everywhere all the time. This virus is going to keep transmitting, whether we like it or not. So our job is to figure out, how can we minimize the number of deaths, the serious illnesses, and the overall impact of society? Because I think everyone agrees. I find no one that agree with the idea that we can shut down society for 18 months and come out the other end and not be a completely changed world in a negative way.
Right.
So what our job is to thread all those together. And I think the most important thing is, just like this discussion right here you and I are having right now, we need to have this discussion to get this started, so that it's not seen as someone who is, you know, has a position that, well, these people are okay casualties. They're acceptable casualties.
Right.
Let them go.
No.
That's not it at all. It's how to have that discussion. And so I think this is why this kind of discussion we're having right now is really important.
Well, I don't want to be too dogged, but I understand the idea that we want to minimize deaths, but I don't, and that there's an inevitability of infection, but do we really want to minimize? I mean, let's just assume, stipulate that 18 months we will get a vaccine, but I don't know how safe it is to stipulate that, but let's just stipulate it for the sake of this conversation.
I agree.
How can we, it seems like there's a little bit of a gray zone in there in terms of, like, yes, I certainly don't want to say I want people to be infected. I certainly don't want to be infected. But at the same time, we need if we're not going to follow down the trajectory of we're inside for 18 months and all the things that come with that problematically, we need people to get infected on some level, right? I mean, it's inevitable, but the idea is that we probably want to attempt to control which cohorts of our society get infected.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly the kind of discussion, again, I would say the gray zone, if rheostat-wise, let me make a friendly amendment here. I would suggest that if we can control infection and keeping people out there, I mean, new ways of distancing, for example. You know, let me just give you one that has been presented to me for my input. What if we brought back Major League Baseball, but there was nobody in the stands? It was only the players and the management, you know, that were there. But we televised it. And the people who did the television work were up in the stands itself, isolated. Would that be a new normal? Well, we've never done that before. But could we do that and actually bring back society in a way that, hey, we're all going home and watch our TV today because we got baseball on? Now, this is the kind of thing we're talking about, is how can you bring back society where you're actually creatively? I mean, look at what happened to the airplanes. Now, we'd all agree that, you know, I feel badly for the airline industry, but we're seeing airlines that normally would be flying 2 million passengers a day flying 30,000. Will that ever come back again? You know, I think about how many meetings I went to around the world for a day. I'd fly to Geneva 3-4 days out of my schedule, jet lag, one day meeting, and now today I do it online. And so I think that some of the things we're also talking about is how to more creatively hold back some of what was before. It's not an either or anymore. You know, it's either nothing and we're locked down, or it's back to normal.
I see.
And so what we're trying to do is craft a society, and we're trying to craft a way to move with this virus. And I think you were right on the mark when you said, are we going to have a vaccine? We have to be very careful and say we don't know. We hope we can. Yesterday there were data that came out in the first studies out of China looking at a vaccine in monkeys that were challenged with the virus after they had been vaccinated, and it looked pretty promising. You know, now that doesn't mean it's coming anytime soon, but I think there's reason to hope. So I think what we're looking for is this kind of creative energy to get us to the end of this so we have that vaccine.
Okay. And so if you were in charge, right? I mean, and it does, I mean, well, I mean, it does, I mean, frankly, it does really feel like we have a vacuum of leadership on this. You know, we have a daily news brief, I guess you could call that, from the president, who's out there literally yesterday saying that, you know, encouraging people, or just saying, like, you know, throwing it out there as if we were just spitballing on, you know, drinking Clorox or something. I mean, that's sheer insanity. But more to the point is that there's, while he's doing that, there's no one behind the curtain going, all right, this is what we're really doing, and looking at a big board here. And I don't know, frankly, how we get there with this administration. I honestly have no concept of how you can have any type of leadership in this context. But if you were that person, would you say that, like, look, we're going to, there are going to be cohorts that can go out there. I get a better idea of what you're talking about when you say the baseball, which is like, let's find areas that will minimize the infection. But if we are this active in minimizing the infection, isn't then the end game just a vaccine? I mean, because we could.
Well, the end game is a vaccine. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The end game is a vaccine. So what I'm trying to do is, it's kind of a three-order effect here. We're trying to hold back the virus. We're trying to keep society from basically imploding as we know it.
Right.
And we're trying to move that vaccine to get us together. So I think that that's the combination. But I think, you know, for example, you know, I participated in a meeting where the medical ethicists raised some incredible questions about ventilator use. And we know that, you know, being on a ventilator in of itself is a bad outcome for this disease.
Right.
But the question was, if we have a young man who's a quad, who basically is being kept alive on a ventilator, and he may have X number of years of life yet, but if his ventilator was available over the course of the next 6 months, we might be able to save 10 lives with that ventilator. And their whole question was, if we don't have any more, do we take his ventilator and give it to those 10 people over time? And those are incredibly, incredibly horrible, horrible discussions. And they're tough because it's about maximizing it. So what I'm saying, at a population level, we have to be prepared to have these discussions. But ideally, what we want to do is get us to the point of where we minimize deaths, we minimize transmission, we maximize society, and we get ourselves a vaccine. And however you slice it, it's going to be tough discussions. Getting back to the question you just raised, let me just, you know, say for what it's worth, because I'm just a soldier in the public health army. I have been for 45 years, and I salute the same flag and the same commander, regardless of who the public health leadership or the elected leadership are of this country. I've served in the last five presidential administrations. Even this one, I was a science envoy for the State Department for a year. I'm sure at the university, I served two Democratic governors, two Republican governors, and one independent governor in Minnesota, a state epidemiologist. And my family couldn't tell you my partisan politics when it comes to those issues. But having said that, I would agree with you 100% right now. Leadership is everything. We're going to have a really, really tough time with this situation. There's nothing easy about it. And I wish we had somebody right now that could do fireside chats. I wish we could have somebody that would just straight talk and just tell us what we know and what we don't know and what we're going to do to get around it. And, you know, somebody's going to tell us we're going to have some hard times, but this is what we're going to do. So number one, I think if I had to do anything right now, is instill that sense of leadership, that sense of trust. This is not a partisan issue. I said 4 weeks ago, when this was starting to evolve into a red and blue state issue, a red and blue county issue, I said, you just wait. There won't be red and blue. There'll be COVID color. Look what's happening right now in rural America, in the agricultural belt, that were primarily red states, and see how this virus is sweeping through there right now, changing everything. Nobody's red and blue anymore in those counties. They're COVID. And so I think that's what we need, is that kind of leadership, first of all. Second of all, there are things we can do right now. This testing fiasco, we need to test, but don't let more people just come and say, test, 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 test. What happened was in December with Wuhan, there was a need for new reagents, the chemicals that run these tests, that were well above and beyond normal consumption for the world. But we were able to expand within the reagent manufacturing world to make more of it. But then when the whole world caught on fire and everybody wanted these reagents, instead of going from a garden hose you know, basically evolving into a fire hose, we suddenly needed a canal worth of these reagents. And today we can't get testing done because of the shortage. Where is our Marshall Plan that the United States could and should lead with the private sector to get these reagents? Instead, we have an argument every day about, is testing really available or not? Right. That's the kind of leadership we need right now.
And just to be clear,
need that.
Reagents are essentially the chemical that would allow you to take the sample from the swab and get it into a,
yep.
a testing the scenario. And so
exactly.
And frankly, it's you need to use the Defense Production Act to get somebody. I don't know what company it is. You might even have a better notion of it. You may have a couple of companies in mind who could actually who have the facilities and could start producing this stuff tomorrow.
Well, that's a challenge. First of all, if you were your whole business was around making widgets and suddenly you're being made to ask mechanical ventilators. Ventilators, by the way, that on average have over 1,500 parts and come from a number of different countries, find machine parts. That's a challenge. But within the industry of reagent making, what do you do to ramp up? What does it take to build that extra capacity? And how do you do it? But you need that leadership. You need coordination. You need somebody to direct it, like a field general. And I could go through a laundry list of these things. The PPE issue, the N95 respirators, the same thing. And so that's the kind of leadership we need right now. I don't want to hear any more about how many products have been delivered that day, okay? Because if you're telling me you're delivering 2 million N95 respirators, that sounds great. But when you realize that the orders that were standing and needed immediately number 12 million, what did 2 million do?
Right.
I mean, it surely helped. But we need that kind of honest discourse and say, we're shorter, but this is what we're going to do. You know, if you really want to understand where we should be right now, go back and listen to FDR and go back and listen to Winston Churchill. You know, they taught us how to do this. They told us hard things, but they told us how we're going to get through it. So that's where I would come from, and I would incorporate these kinds of issues. I mean, a good example right now, I'm a public health guy, okay? I'm fully acknowledging that. I think the lack of CDC's role in national policy discussions on modeling and all the things we do has been horrible shortcoming. And, you know, it's like going to war, but deciding because for whatever reason you didn't like the tank division, you're not going to bring the tanks in.
Right.
You know, that's not helpful.
And it's really, I think the proper analogy is you don't like the color of the tanks. I mean, there's a real sense that the way this thing is being organized is by the whims of, you know, with all due respect to my daughter, a junior high school kid, essentially, who is not really assessing what different it seems to be a function of just like who's giving me bad news. You're out of the picture. But I know I have a couple of minutes here with you because I know that you have a heart out here. Let me just ask you this.
Yeah.
What do we know about this disease now, particularly in terms of its transmission? I mean, should we be washing down, if I get a box from UPS in cardboard, should I be washing that down? Should I be doing that with bags? Should I?
Yeah.
I mean, what is the best practices that we understand now, and how has that changed over the past 2 months, let's say?
Yeah, the first, second, and third order of transmission with this virus is air, 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 and air. Okay, we now know that respiratory transmission is by far the major component piece of transmission. And it's not just air right around you. Unfortunately, it does include what we call aerosols, these things that you and I have been generating the whole time in this conversation. And whatever room each of us are in, we've pretty much got those floating around. Think about the last time you saw sunlight coming through the window in your home or your place of work, and you saw that stuff floating on it, and you thought, boy, this is pretty dusty in here. Those are aerosols. Those actually from you and I just talking. We create those, okay? And so that's a challenge. These are the same aerosols, by the way. When you go to a department store and you're four aisles away, you can smell the perfume section. And so that is a problem. This is a readily transmitted virus by that way. Some people transmit to very few people. We have some household settings where someone doesn't transmit to anybody. Then we have those situations where some people transmit to as many as 50 to 100 people. And so the transmission's variable. I think the question, though, that you really wanted to get at was those all that surface contamination. Do I need to wipe everything off? This plays a very, very small role, if much at all. in the transmission of this virus. You know, the idea of contaminating a surface and touching it and putting it to your face. Clearly, your eyes do have receptor cells for this virus. They could become infected through the eye, but it really is a small role. So it is about breathing air, and this is where distancing does come in. You know, if I'm not right in that same room a long period of time with someone, I have a much lower chance of getting infected.
If someone's in my car, let's say, and they're infected, and I come into that car 5 hours later, is the aerosol still in there? Does it make sense for me to go like, well, I'll get in the car, but I'm opening both doors first and I'm going to let it air out for 10 minutes.
Yeah. You know, if somebody was in the car with you or before you,
before me,
and they were infected, literally just opening the car doors and letting air through there, that'll dissipate quickly. You know, that's what I'd be concerned about. I wouldn't be so concerned about, you know, any other part of the car. Just letting that air out. That's important.
So, and the upside, I guess, of heading into summer is that people can, if they want to socialize and you're 6-7 feet away across a porch or stairs or on the street, mm-hmm. And you're out in the open, that's a much better place to be than inside a room.
Absolutely. You know, I just got an email this morning from a very creative father who's wants to have his son's team play baseball this summer, you know, and in light of our baseball discussion. And he had a very elaborate way to keep the kids apart, you know, even to the extent that they have team balls for which one team handles and the other team doesn't, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The umpire stands behind the pitcher as opposed to behind the plate. You know, to even have a catcher, you know, you just have him stand back by the screen, pick up the ball. And he was really thinking creatively about how could we get these kids together and keep them apart far enough outside that, you know, we don't just end that. And, you know, that's the kind of creative thinking we need right now.
I mean,
you know, I would say
frankly,
the risk is probably very low of that.
The biggest problem, though, is that, I do this every day. I read about this stuff. And there has been no source of information that has said, you know, like it's, I mean, we're around the edges, air, but there's been no source of information that has said the simple things that you have said that, you know, give me a sense of like where I should be most careful, where I shouldn't. Like, we just don't hear that. There's nobody announcing that information.
Well, we're trying. Okay. When we, every day we focus on, do we have enough tests or not? Every day, when we focus on what's the source of this, you know, whether it's a Chinese war weapon, intentional release, et cetera, we're missing exactly the points we're saying. You know, I've been saying for 3 months, we are learning how to die with this virus, and it's horrible. It's painful. Personally, it's impacted me. But you know what? We have to also figure out how to live with it until we can get to the point of where hopefully we're going to have that magic bullet. So this kind of discussion we're having right now is exactly the kind everybody needs to be having about how do we live with this thing. And so I couldn't agree with you more. You're absolutely right. This is what we need for information.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, thank you so much for your time today. I can't thank you enough, and I really hope we have the opportunity to do this again. I know you're incredibly busy, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, you know, and I think you're having this conversation. It's people like you in our communities that can help legitimize and help put forward and actually demand this kind of conversation. You can demand this kind of, you know, leadership as such. So I just want to thank you, and I hope more people take you up on the kind of discussions you're putting forward here. This is what we need right now. We need this. That's the leadership we're talking about.
Michael Osterholm. Thank you. Thank you very much, Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Thanks again. All right, folks. You can get, we'll put a link to that center and the information they're putting out. And maybe we'll do that to Osterholm's book. But, you know, spoiler alert, we know what happens. In terms of the pandemic. And it really is, I mean, just, and again, you know, I think Osterholm is one of the top epidemiologists in the country, but I still feel like my sense is we're still learning about this disease. So I think it's better to be personally, from my perspective, I would rather err on the side of being too cautious than not. But, you know, in terms of like, I'll wash things down if maybe. But I think at the very least, that sensitivity to distance and to air and in being in confined spaces with folks is a really important thing to keep in mind. We're going to take a break and head into the fun half. Michael Brooks will be joining me there, as we will also be taking phone calls. A reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content every day, on top of which you're also making the free show possible. And, you know, advertising a little bit rough these days, but I don't know if it will get better, but my hope is it will at least stabilize. So it is really our members who are making, who are carrying us through at this time. And I want to thank them very much. And again, if you're somebody who does not have the resources to become a member, or you're concerned, or you're already a member and you're concerned about your finances, if you're a member already, head over to the cancellation page. We have some options for you. And if you're not a member and you want access to the content and you don't have the resources, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will lock nobody out for money reasons. Really, it's just, we just lock out people for attitude reasons. But I haven't done that in a long time. I almost did it to somebody recently. Called in and says, like, you're jamming Joe Biden down my throat or something like that. And I think they had already claimed that they had quit. So I was like, well, all right. Don't forget, last night was Tuesday night, TMBS. Matt, who was on there?
Yeah, we had Yolian Ogbu, organizer, and Judah Friedlander, the comedian. And actually, David Griscom and I had to conduct the interview for a little bit because Michael's internet was not behaving well. So we talked to him about comedy and politics for about an hour. It was really nice.
Oh, that's good. Cool. So you can check out the Matt and Griscom's interview stylings with Judah Friedlander on TMBS. Also, check out Noah McKee's show. The Noah McKee Show on Patreon.com or YouTube.com. The Noah McKee Const Show. Also, The Antifada. Check that out at Patreon.com. The Antifada. And Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover, or as I call it, the Bandwidth Chewer Upper? That denies everybody else, apparently, well, in your block, it feels like.
I don't know about that, but the Literary Hangover, we just did a new podcast episode on Daniel Defoe's A Journal from the Plague Year, which was written in 1722, 2 years after the last instance of the plague flared up in France. And it was set, the novel, it's sort of a novel slash journal.
Wait, when was this?
The novel was written in 1722, 2 years after the 1720 outbreak of the plague.
1720 plague, okay.
But the novel is about a journal set in the 1665 outbreak of the plague in London, from the point of view of a guy who has like servants and stuff, and who he didn't prepare for terribly well, and he has to have those conversations. Like, actually, you're not coming with me to the suburbs. Good luck in London. That was a big dynamic. So we talk about that sort of stuff. So yeah, check that out. And also subscribe to me on Twitch if you do that, twitch.tv/literary hangover. Doing a lot of groundbreaking stuff over there, I think.
Did you know that there was a pandemic in 1890?
I'm not aware of that one.
And so a lot of people, when the 1918 pandemic happened, had experience with it.
Mm. In Defoe's journal, he talks about how there's a woman who was around from the 1630s and she would only give advice to women. Who wouldn't give advice to men about the 1665 one. So interesting tactics.
Very odd. Very odd. Strange times. All right, we're going to take a quick break when we head back. Fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.